I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, a nation of immigrants, a work in progress, and acutely these days, an idea, an identity in dispute. Familiar voices mark the shifting center on immigration. George H.W. Bush and Ronald Reagan, the Republican rivals in 1980, then back to John Kennedy in the 60s.
I'd like to see something done about the illegal alien problem that would be so sensitive and so understanding about labor needs and human needs that that problem wouldn't come up. If they're living here, I don't want to see a whole thing of 6- and 8-year-old kids made to feel that they're living with outside the law. Let's address ourselves to the fundamentals. These are good people, strong people. Part of my family is a Mexican.
We're talking about putting up a fence. Why don't we work out some recognition of our mutual problems, make it possible for them to come here legally with a work permit, and then while they're working and earning here, they pay taxes here. And when they want to go back, they can go back, and they can cross and open the border both ways.
It is a proud privilege to be a citizen of the great republic, to hear its song sung, to realize that we are the descendants of 40 million people who left other countries, other familiar scenes, to come here to the United States to build a new life, to make a new opportunity for themselves and their children. I think it is not a burden, but a privilege to have the chance in 1963 to share that great concept, which they felt so deeply, among all of our people. To make this really, as it was for them, a new world for us, and indeed for all those who look to us. That's what this country has stood for 200 years, and that's what this country will continue to stand for.
And now comes Donald Trump, Republican frontrunner for 2016.
I will build a great, great wall on our southern border, and I will have Mexico pay for that wall. When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. They're sending us not the right people. It's coming from more than Mexico. It's coming from all over South and Latin America, and it's coming probably from the Middle East.
We're going to be saying you have to go back to wherever the country is. I mean, it's going to be countries, all different countries. It's not one country. We'll take them back to those countries. We're going to do it in a very humane way. But they're going to have to go, and they're going to have to come back in legally. Otherwise, we don't have a country.
If I win, they're going back. They're going back. I'm telling you. They're going back.
How did Donald Trump know, and what did he know, that pollsters, big media, professional candidates didn't seem to anticipate about the fire in people's hearts around who gets to live here and call themselves American? The Tufts sociologist Helen Marrow, who has done her own immigration fieldwork, is in our cast this hour. Also, the anthropologist of the Mexican border, Claudio Lomnitz at Columbia. We begin with history and Aziz Rana from Cornell's Law School. His remarkable book on something deeper than paradox is titled The Two Faces of American Freedom. I asked Aziz Rana to start with those awkward jokes around the Thanksgiving table this year about the nation of immigrants on the verge of an anti-immigrant panic.
You know, many ways the present moment seems like it's marked by this paradox that we think of ourselves as an immigrant nation, as open to everybody from all over the world. And yet at the same time, we see an intense brand of xenophobia in our presence and a set of policies actually that have also been on the books since the 1990s that are quite draconian, that lead over 400,000 immigrants yearly to cycle through county jails and detention centers. But what I would say is that this isn't just a matter of failing to live up to our ideals or some kind of inconsistency. It has to do with a deep history that we remember and we forget. We remember ourselves as immigrants, but we forget the reason why, especially in the 18th and 19th century, that we had open immigration policies for Europeans. And that was because it facilitated a project of colonial settlement. We were settlers too, and settlers of a particular racially circumscribed sort. And what we're seeing at present, in a way, is two sides of the same coin. The reason why we had those open immigration policies were tied to a very exclusionary project of taking over land and taking over land for the right kind of citizens.
You remind us that this was an imperial project from the beginning by immigrants. Walk us through the pecking order, the sort of the A list of immigrants we wanted, and then the long B list of unfashionable immigrants, which were Catholics for a long time. How did we come to that ranking system?
Who counted as properly American really changed over time. But let's say from the 17th until the early 20th century, if we think of the U.S. as a kind of project and settlement, not unlike the British in Australia or South Africa or New Zealand, the basic thought was that you had Anglo-Protestant settlers that were trying to create a free republic on North American soil. And this required removing native peoples. And it also required finding other communities, those that were thought of as quote unquote unfit to do the hard, coercive work, particularly African slaves. But what English colonists and their descendants realized almost from the beginning is that you're not going to be able to create a new, let's say, white American republic in North America unless you had enough people. And so they created policies to induce the right kinds of migrants, migrants that were viewed as people that could share the same basic culture and commitment to republican institutions and economic self-rule. And at first, in the 17th and 18th century, really what they were looking for were European Protestants. So Catholics were not allowed.
Right.
There was a worry that Catholicism was a religion of quote-unquote absolutism, because you paid attention to what the Pope said. You didn't think spiritually about what your own values and goals were. You didn't learn a habit through your religious practice, a habit in self-rule. And that was a general view of Catholicism in large chunks of the country, even after independence. But this actually started to shift in the mid-19th century because of a simple fact. Well, if you want to settle the continent, you need people, and who's coming? In the 1840s and 1850s, it was overwhelmingly German and Irish immigrants, and a large chunk of those were Catholic.
And then all the others. I mean,
yeah.
Africans came as slaves. Mexicans we'll get to, but in a class by themselves. What about Asians?
So in the second half of the 19th century, something like 250,000 Chinese migrants came, and they came in search of better wages and jobs. But Chinese were viewed at this time as culturally unfit, similarly coming from a political culture of absolutism, not sharing the same religious practices, not having the kind of qualities or characteristics that could make them free citizens.
Yeah.
The thing that's concerning to me is that this basic framework that combines inclusion with exclusion has remained persistent and continuous. It's just that which communities we place in which boxes have changed depending on domestic politics and especially on American foreign policy. The difference really between now and then wasn't really about Chinese. It was about the fact that China and Japan in the early 20th century were viewed as growing, potentially threatening, self-assertive new powers.
Hmm.
Today, we tend to see the threats as coming from instability in the Middle East in a way that wasn't the case then.
Come back to the universal nation, the nation of nations, the transnation and its charms. A lot of us still love that fundamental idea. I always think of, you know, the all-American novel, Moby Dick. There are 41 nations represented in the crew of the whale ship Pequod, and they're the heroes of the story. None more than Queequeg, the most competent among them all, the South Sea cannibal. We've elected a president with roots in Kenya as well as Kansas. What if that is still, and maybe even more than ever, the idea of ourselves?
There's an element of that universal story that to me is really some of the best parts of American identity and has been central to the most important political changes that we've seen over the course of the 20th century. It's fed civil rights movement. It's fed a politics of inclusion that says that everybody, regardless of race, religion, gender, sexual orientation, is worthy of equal dignity and equal rights. But it has its own underside that we also have to recognize. And the underside, in a way, connects to that latent seed of xenophobia that Trump has been playing on. And it's this thought that the idea of the U.S. as a universal nation is really closely connected to the idea of the U.S. as an exceptional nation. That there's a reason why in the U.S., as opposed to these other European countries, other places around the globe, that you had the possibility of the Enlightenment coming down to Earth through the Constitution and the Declaration. And that's because of a very particular or special cultural history. And this means that new communities should rightly be assimilated. They should be Americanized. And that those abroad, when we project American power, that when we're projecting American interests, we're really projecting their interests. And they should in various ways be Americanized too, through constitutions that mimic our own or through practices that are equivalent to how we organize political life domestically. And it leads to something that I think is quite troubling, because the very successes of assimilation in the past with particular kinds of European immigrant communities makes Americans oftentimes think, well, the problem that we're having now in places like the Middle East, or the tensions that are surfacing on the farm or in the factory with Mexican immigrants or immigrants from Central and Latin America, is because of them, because they've failed to become culturally like us. And it produces a cycle between inclusion and exclusion. It explains why somebody like Trump can say in the same breath, he can be surrounded by African-American pastors. He can say in the same breath that Rosa Parks should be on the $10 bill, while also resuscitating policies that mimic some of the worst practices of the American 20th century, practices that we thought we'd moved past forever.
Aziz Rana teaches constitutional law at Cornell. His book is The Two Faces of American Freedom. Coming up, the game changer Donald Trump and his base in central Massachusetts charged up on what pollsters said was number 14 or something on the list of what people really care about. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Ledden. This is Open Source. Who are we, after all, this global melting pot nation in heated campaign rage these many months now around the idea of a fortified wall across our long southern border? That wall has been the emotional icon of Donald Trump's surging campaign for the Republican presidential nomination. When Trump came to Worcester in November, our producer Pat Tomaino went to meet the people power behind him, voters from Rhode Island and New Hampshire, as well as Massachusetts, people with lively and articulate definitions of an us-against-them view of the world.
So amazing. And by the way, do we love Tom Brady? Do we love Tom Brady? Great guy. He's a great guy. Great guy and a great winner. And I'll tell you, you're lucky to have him. You're lucky to have him.
We're from Shirley, Mass. America has to wake up and understand. And I don't know if it's true, but I'm trying to find the data that I heard earlier today that some Syrian refugees were coming into Leominster, bust in, and they're at a hotel. I don't know if that's true, but I know the governors are talking that they don't want the refugees, but I think we're being lied to because they're coming in anyway.
I don't know if we should deport everyone that's illegal. I think we should maybe deport the ones that are criminal. Every person should have a look at, and there should be some certain criteria. And if that criteria passes, then they should stay here. I still hope he builds the wall, though, you know.
If you don't have a border, you don't have a country.
I think, yeah, no, overkill is the point with Mexico. Kind of the idea to deport 11 million people, I think, is unrealistic. It'd be similar to, like, Nazi Germany, to be honest. But I think he has the right idea with immigration when it comes to enforcing, like building a wall and making sure people can have a free ride.
He's really hung up on immigration. This whole wall thing is, I don't know if he can really accomplish it, but it'll be entertaining.
The wall thing is good jobs, great jobs.
He just keeps reaffirming the fact that he's a strong leader. I love his vision. I would like to see this country a less welcoming place for people who are not willing to come here and assimilate. I would like to press one for English less. by the time I'm an old man, and he might help accomplish something like that. I like diversity, and I think he does too. Diversity of beauty, diversity of art, food, music, fashion, diversity of skills. I don't like the idea of diversity of values. Diversity of values leads to conflict, and I think that we're seeing that in Paris. You will soon see it in Germany, I suspect. Diversity of values leads to conflict. And the left treats diversity as if it's an absolute good, but it's not true. Diversity of values leads to conflict. And I don't think anyone else understands it to the degree that Trump does.
Helen Marrow is our studio guest, up-and-coming sociologist of immigration, from North Carolina originally, then Princeton, now teaching at Tufts. Welcome, Helen Marrow. You've written a sunnier side of how immigrants and natives get along at the conversational and community level in this country today. But we'll get to that. For what did you hear in that Trump crowd?
Thank you for having me here tonight, Chris. I first heard that we love Tom Brady, and I also know that he is married to an immigrant who is a very successful example of assimilation. I also heard a lot of, I don't know, and I heard a lot of ambivalence about what's happening and what might be right. I heard a lot of lack of information and a lot of ambivalence.
Has the man there got a point about the overselling of diversity? Europe certainly seems to feel that it's over the speed limit on the assimilation of foreigners.
I would like to speak to that not normatively. I would like to speak to that in terms of the research. The evidence that we have shows that no, diversity of values does not lead to conflict. In fact, one of the projects I'm engaged in right now shows that diversity in the United States increases face-to-face contact between natives and immigrants and also increases intergroup trust between them and increases civic engagement.
For example, how does that work out on the street or in the church or in the neighborhood?
Mm-hmm.
And you're talking Atlanta. Where else? Philadelphia?
Mm-hmm. The work we're doing right now is in Atlanta and Philadelphia. What it means is that when you have immigration-driven racial and ethnic diversity, that more people have the chance to meet each other in a workplace, in a neighborhood, on the street, in public spaces, particularly in schools with the younger generation. And when they meet each other, when they have that chance to meet face-to-face, a lot of people worry that this is going to tear us apart. Actually, in fact, it helps us get to know each other and change our views. It increases our trust in each other, and it makes all of us, both the natives and the immigrants, more civically engaged.
What does that man mean about values, though? I mean, decode what that word. It's not about, he's saying it's not about color or even creed. It's about something deeper.
I don't want to be too presumptuous. I want to point out that I don't know what he means by values. I think one of the greatest things about this country is that we are fundamentally based on what we call an American creed, which is an amalgamation of political values, belief in individualism, in self-reliance, in work ethic, in freedom of speech, in freedom of religion, even Republican values, a commitment to civic engagement. There are a lot of values. There are a lot of different ones. And I'm not exactly sure what values he's saying are incompatible with that.
Well, I'm not either. But what do you take to be happening out there? I mean, a year ago, nobody would have thought Donald Trump would be a contender, and nobody would have thought that the campaign might turn around immigration.
Mm-hmm. Well, immigration, we know, is an issue that is never on the top of anyone's list. It's never a number one issue that people vote on. But there are such things known as issue entrepreneurs that can make great use of it. I think no one saw Trump coming, but he's been one of the best issue entrepreneurs that we've seen so far. This is not surprising. So maybe we didn't see him coming, but he's done it well. I think what is going on with the people who are supporting them? Probably many things. This is a large group of people who have a lot of heterogeneity. I'm not going to speak about them as just one group, but I do think what he's playing to is economic and cultural and also racial anxiety. And that anxiety stems in large part from things that don't have anything to do with immigration or immigrants or Muslims. That anxiety is larger, but it's always nice to have a scapegoat, and that's where issue entrepreneurs come in.
Is there more to say briefly about anxiety? I mean, there is a fear, an ISIS in Paris or, you know, another mass shooter episode in San Bernardino doesn't help either. But
right.
There is a dread in the air, and a lot of it has sort of landed on the wire of immigration.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the first thing to point out is that dread has been in the air a long time, and I agree with Aziz that this goes back decades and decades, if not centuries. This fear was in the air about Mexicans well before ISIS. This fear has been growing about Muslims. I believe in the past decade, research by Chris Bale shows that the percentage of Americans who thinks that Muslims are a problem has doubled in the last 10 years. This was all before ISIS. So I don't think that anxiety is about the current terrorist threat. I think that anxiety has a lot deeper economic as well as cultural and racial roots.
Aziz Rana was telling us he hears at least three layers in the Trump crowds, sort of the blues of economic downturn, and then specifically a backlash against the immigrant rights political campaigns reminiscent of the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. But third, inescapably, he says a latent, deep, real xenophobia in our culture, in our history. Mm-hmm. Want to add or subtract to that or not?
I think that's a very astute observation. We know that these things work in cycles, and at least for the past couple of decades, we've seen several cycles, right? There's a movement toward immigrant rights, which produces a backlash against immigrant rights, which produces a greater mobilization of people pushing for immigrant rights. And in fact, I would say, we want to point out, right, as bad as what's happening right now, the kinds of xenophobic and nativist and racist things that Trump is saying, not only about Mexicans, but now also about Muslims and a host of other people, in some ways, that's going to produce distrust and hunkering down among Mexican immigrants. But it's also going to be the best thing that happens to them in the worst way possible in terms of ethnically mobilizing them. For example, I just read the other day, Latino Decisions, a group estimates that approximately 73,000 Latinos are becoming eligible to vote every month. What he is saying is producing a sense of discrimination, a sense of political engagement and of activism, and we are going to see record numbers of Latinos registering to vote.
What other effects do you observe? There's another dimension I'd like to hear about, sort of parallels or differences between European Islamophobia and our own, you know, Latinophobia or whatever it is. But do you connect them?
Parallels between European Islamophobia and American Mexicanophobia?
Something.
yes. Well, I think there have been historical connections. One of the things in immigration we like to note is that for a long time, Europe has a deep-seated fear of religion. Many of the European countries were formed at times that they were connected to a particular religion, right? You think of the UK being connected to the Protestant church, the Church of England, and you think of other countries similarly being one religion in one state. The U.S. was formed differently. We have a separation of church and state that, even though is not perfect, keeps these things separate in our political life. So Europe has always had a problem with dealing with religious diversity, and you're seeing a lot of that right now. It's much more comfortable with linguistic diversity, for example, but it's very, very, very uncomfortable with accommodating religious diversity, and it's not well poised to do that. We have done better, at least until recently, with accommodating religious diversity. Certainly, Jewish immigrants and Catholic immigrants have now become part of the quote-unquote mainstream. mainstream.
The whole Supreme Court, have you noticed?
Right. They are our mainstream now. You know, and it's funny. Europe is so comfortable with language, and we are so scared of language. We have always, always been scared of foreign language.
What do you mean?
It has gotten under our skin, right? You're hearing from those Trump supporters, I would like to press one in English less, right? You know, the first thing to notice about this, there's a big generational gap going on. You hear that a lot from Americans who are my age or older, right, who grew up in a time when we were at the nadir of immigration levels, who didn't grow up in a place where we had lots of contact with immigrants, other children of immigrants, and they're very anxious by this. There's some new data showing that people who are my age or younger don't have as big a problem with it. In fact, when they report their grandparents saying, "I'm so mad that I have to press one for English," they're saying, "Hey, just press one. Yeah, I don't understand what
but
the
behind
problem
it
is."
In this country, maybe older generations, but is a fear that they don't want to learn our ways. They don't want to learn. Mm-hmm. They don't want to assimilate.
Right, right.
Who gave up on assimilation? Or I think maybe the immigrants will be the last to give up on
right.
it. But why does that bug people so?
It is really interesting. It is something that we as scholars, knowing the research, are really baffled by. There really is no group of people more excited about trying to assimilate than new immigrants. And language, paradoxically, is the place where we are least concerned. In fact, if anything, what is hard to hold on to are the foreign languages. English is so dominant throughout the world today that many of our immigrants know it before they come, even from Latin America. They get taught it abroad. They know it before they come, and they express very strong desires to learn it because they want to learn it and they want to progress in their lives in the USA. And that's learning English is the way you do that,
maybe
I guess.
Maybe they're pressing one for English.
Maybe they are pressing one for English. Many of them try to. Many of them try to actually get their children into English language classes.
Helen, you do actual field work among immigrants and others. I want to hear some of the sad and happy stories of your professional life. I mean, you see new immigrants in old neighborhoods in Philadelphia, Atlanta, Boston, the South. What's the worst behavior you see routinely, and what's the best?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, let's start with the best. I think we, in this era of Trump and politics, we really miss the forest through the trees. A lot of the story of modern immigration today is positive. There is so much integration happening. There is so much "quote unquote" assimilation happening. If you are to look at the big picture, immigrants are getting jobs. They are gaining an education. If you look over the generation, progressively over each generation, from an immigrant parent to a child to a grandchild to a great-grandchild, there are gains made in education, in economics, in housing, in politics, even in intermarriage.
Yeah,
right?
People have noticed before that the upward mobility in this country today is among immigrants. They're doing much better than a lot of the natives at the middle and lower registers.
Mm-hmm. Well, it depends, right? You know, many of the immigrants come in better off than natives to begin with now. We have a bifurcated skill set, and so many immigrants come in today with better educational skills than natives to begin with. So if you were asked them, what does assimilation mean? I hope it doesn't mean going downward to the level of natives, right? But they are coming in very highly selected, and they do extremely well, right? That wasn't something we had 100 years ago. But even at the lower level, right, we're now changing our tune in terms of describing Mexican immigrants. They make such vast educational and economic progress across the generations that they could be called our most successful immigrant group. That story, you asked also about the negative. I would say, you know, we don't pay enough attention to that. We don't pay enough attention to all the good things because our media and our myths focus on two things. One, undocumented immigration at the expense of the rest of the story, and also the story of blocked mobility at the expense of the upward mobility. And those two things are really critical. Undocumented immigrants face a host of barriers. They are not doing as well, right? And they're not doing as well because they don't want to assimilate or they don't want to learn English. They're doing not well because we're not letting them. We're standing in their way. We're blocking their paths. They can't get jobs. They can't work. They can't go to school. They can't go to college.
They get raided in factories where they do work hard.
Not only that, they're living in a state of constant fear. They're living in a state of constant fear. We've taken away driver's licenses. I think 75% of Latinos today know someone who's been deported. They're scared of deportation. Mm. There's an enormous amount of hunkering down. And some of the research is even showing us today, especially among the children, there's really high levels of chronic stress, anxiety, fear. These children are internalizing this, and they're beginning for the first time in American history to interpret what having an immigrant heritage means as something to be ashamed of rather than to be proud of.
That's new.
That is new.
Who's telling them to be ashamed, or how does it work itself out?
Who's telling them to be ashamed? Everyone. Listen to what we're hearing. We're hearing people in the media, politicians, the public voice is saying illegal is bad, illegal is wrong, right? No one is supporting them, and they can't help but internalize this.
Helen Merrill of Tufts University is our guest sociologist. We're talking about immigrants, the immigrant idea, the nation of immigrants in Donald Trump time. Coming up, the special case of the United States and Mexico, the inflamed border of as old and intimate cultural and economic relationship as we have in the world. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Donald Trump's wall along the Mexican border from Tijuana and San Diego, California, across the edges of Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas to the Gulf Coast is one metaphor for a relationship. But Mexico itself, in American conversation, has become a dense metaphor of an endlessly complex backstory. I asked the anthropologist Claudio Lomnitz to begin by deciphering the Mexico in our minds. He is Mexican by adoption, Chilean by birth, with a flair for anecdote and symbols. His big book is Death and the Idea of Mexico. I asked him, what do we talk about when we talk about Mexico?
Mexico was in some way kind of extension of the idea of the West, the Wild West in American imagination. The West became central to Americans' ideas about themselves, Americans' notions about freedom, notions about the individual and the connection between the individual and society. And that connection includes the significance of a kind of horizon of lawlessness. You know, the West was originally a place that had no law, and then law is established along with settling. Mexico was the land beyond the law, if you know what I mean, where sort of exotic things can happen. It used to be that people crossed the border into, let's say, Tijuana to bet on the horse tracks, or soldiers in El Paso went to visit prostitutes in Ciudad Juarez or to drink in the bars. It used to be that the movement had a kind of racy, eroticized dimension. But now there's also a deadlier, scarier side that is connected to the drug war, and I think
it's now been narcotized and criminalized.
Completely. And there again, you see this problem of hypocrisy in the sense that it's true, I think, by and large, that Mexican farmers, peasants and the like, coming from very poor regions like the state of Guerrero or the rural parts that used to be of Sinaloa, would have had not a huge problem planting marijuana or planting poppy seeds to sell in the American market, even if they did harm to the U.S. But it's also true that Americans have had no problems manufacturing guns and selling them in Mexico, where they're illegal, and where they've killed, over 130,000 people in the last 9 years, which I don't think you can say about Mexican drugs. Yes, there is a drug trade, and yes, there is a major crime problem, except the U.S. is part of it. And they can't just pretend like this is happening somewhere out there. There are some images about Mexico and the U.S. that really stick in my mind as especially horrible. And one of them is about 4 or 5 years ago, when Ciudad Juarez was more dangerous, literally more dangerous than Baghdad. It was, I think, the most or the second most dangerous city in the world. El Paso, which is right across, was the second safest city in the country. How do you live with that? I mean, why is Ciudad Juárez unsafe? Well, it's unsafe because it's on the border with the U.S. I mean, the whole illegal market is connected to the U.S. The U.S. is basically handing over its relationship to Mexico to the DEA. It's embarrassing.
Claudio Lomnitz, what's the polite way to summon your fascination with the death cult in Mexico?
The fascination has to do, I think, with Mexico's completely unusual, original, in many ways, kind of exciting cultural development of death. The U.S. sees itself as a country of freedom, and there's a lot to say for that view. But there's another way in which Mexico is more deeply free. The American obsession with security, for example, including life insurance and retirement funds, fences separating houses and the whole thing, in the end, becomes a lack of existential freedom because you get completely roped into an obsession with your security, and that means living in fear. And if you want to liberate yourself from that, you do have to confront death and age and these kinds of things. Let me give you a little anecdote about freedom. I was in Tijuana about 2 years ago, and I was being taken around by some colleagues from the university there. And they were showing me the wall. The wall is a really horrible thing. It looks different in different stretches, you know. So the stretch that's right on the coast and the beach is kind of sort of kindler, gentler sort of wall. It's a set of beams, actually. Little animals can scurry through and you can look on the other side and see the coastline. It doesn't interrupt visually the way it does further inland. So I was on that stretch of the wall, and there's a lot of graffiti. A lot of the graffiti is written by Americans, actually. So this is one that was clearly written by American in English. And it said, please don't feed the gringos. So Americans looking at the U.S. from Mexico, it's the U.S. that looks a little caged in by the wall. Mm. And that's an interesting thing, and I don't think Americans realize how they're fencing themselves in. There's been a kind of fantasy of autonomy, that the U.S. can just deal with the world and it doesn't rely on any particular part of it. That is just not true to the facts. I mean, the U.S. has always had a special connection with Mexico in particular, but also lots of Central America, lots of the Caribbean, and probably all of Latin America. That special relationship was always framed imperialistically. It was like the Monroe Doctrine, you know, America for the Americans. And there was sort of two senses of the word America. America on the one hand was the United States, on the other was the whole of the hemisphere. Well, you know, maybe it's time to just get past the sort of imperialistic moment and say, well, look, the U.S. has a deeper history in the Western Hemisphere than it has with anyone else except England. Mm. You know, I think that there's there's like a historical debt of recognition that Americans aren't really even beginning to visualize. They have Mexicans, you know, right in front of them all the time. And those Mexicans are treated as if they were like phantasmic figures, like you can just see right through them.
What does Mexico want to teach a country like ours that denies death? We don't even like to talk about old age. We're all 20-something forever.
So Mexico had like a near-death experience. I mean, it had its war with the United States in 1848. And then shortly after that, it suffered an invasion from France in the 1860s. And in the middle of that, there was a civil war. So the country as a whole was really at risk of not existing. In other words, you're talking about a country that has faced a possible death as a country. And that's not so common.
But let me ask, what if it's the acquaintance with death that is the scariest part of Mexico for the rest of us?
Well, I'm sure it is. But I think it's also a highly liberating part of Mexico. And
personify it. If Mexico could sit down and take America by the hand and say, let me tell you what I've learned about death, how would it sound?
On an individual level, it would say, first, you have to be more attentive to your own dead and to your relationship to those of yours who have passed. You do not need a taboo on that subject. It doesn't need to be as fearful as you think. And the people who you love who are gone are people who you can continue to have some kind of a dialogue with, rather than imagining that that dialogue is broken. That's the first thing. Another message is, we don't control everything. This American fantasy with control over everything, which is manifested in so many ways in the society, including in the legal system, right? Lawsuits up and down on absolutely everything. And there is no such thing as an accident in the United States. But there's something about the American existential attitude where it's like Atlas. You're sort of carrying the world on your shoulders, completely exhausted. And the collective fantasy about carrying the whole world in the United States is extremely dangerous, in addition to being painful for Americans. I mean, Americans have a completely overblown view of themselves and of their role in the world. And they imagine that if they decided to change this or that, the whole world would go along with them. I mean, they need to relax a little more. And that involves an acceptance of death. I do think so.
Claudio Lomnitz is professor of anthropology at Columbia. Helen Merrill is professor of sociology at Tufts. He said so many interesting things, but he makes it a vast gulf of culture and values, Helen Merrill. But as a conflict, he says, we in Mexico, the conflict is oversold and entirely misrepresented. Do you want to trump him on that, so to speak?
I just love his work. You know, values are big things, but they're porous, right? Like borders, values are porous. I was also thinking as he was talking, you know, Mexico is often set up as being what we call a familial country. People talk about values of familism, right? That people are heavily committed to their families there. And sometimes the U.S. tries to paint that as an anti-individualistic type of value. But isn't it funny, right? Isn't it funny that in our own country, we also value family, right? And that one of the core values of the very Republican Party Trump is running for is family values, right? These things are far more porous. I think we share more between us than are different. And there's a lot more, I think, that is compatible and that we could learn from each other.
But speak to the rawness in the relationship. Starting with the fact that illegal has become every Mexican sort of middle name. Mm-hmm. There's a ceaseless kind of denigration of the imagery, and Donald Trump walks right into it. But what's the problem here?
Mm-hmm. I would answer that in two ways. The first way is this is really unfortunate. Claudio is right. We have a special relationship with Mexico, and we've had one for a long time. It has been imperialistic in nature, right? But it also is Mexico is our largest trading partner. It is the
larger than Canada. We're close? Or,
it may
what do you
be.
Mean?
You think of NAFTA, right? Canada and Mexico are our largest trading partners. I'm thinking of NAFTA at this point. We're a unit. We're a three-country unit at this point.
Okay.
Our trade has increased. Our tourism has increased. Our commerce with them has increased. Everything has increased. And the one thing that we have tightened rather than relaxed over the last couple of decades is the flow of people. Labor. And it's strange, right, that we try to integrate everything else about us in the special relationship between Canada, the U.S. and Mexico, and at the same time try to block out labor. It's fundamentally incompatible. And so I think the second way I would answer that, right, it's paradoxical that the term illegal, I would call it lack of legal status, right, has fallen down on Mexico. It wasn't created for them. It was created for the Chinese in 1882 with the Chinese Exclusion Act, right? That was an inherently, going back to Assis's comments, that was inherently an exclusive and explicitly racial way that we, for the first time, kept a racial national group out of the country. And then we extended it to the southern and eastern Europeans in the next 40 years. And so we first had Chinese illegal immigrants, then we had European illegal immigrants, right? At that time, we had no caps on any kind of immigration from the Western Hemisphere, and we didn't until 1965 and then 1972. So when the term illegal came about, and it didn't exist then like it knew today. It was never meant to apply to Mexicans, and it's paradoxical, and it's unfortunate that just at the time when immigration from the Western Hemisphere opens up and begins to increase and come to the U.S., that we've developed this term that's now going to fall down on them, and that's why it becomes their middle.
You were heading in the direction before of saying that we're creating an underclass of Latino immigrants in this country. Expand that on the point of Mexicans specifically, and why are we ignoring the good news?
Well, there's a lot of good news to be talked about. I will say the place where we do need to worry most, right? Illegal is not a status. You can't call a person illegal. Illegal is not a fixed static thing. It's not something that a person is. A person is a person. You can't be legal or illegal. The only thing that can be legal or illegal is an act. It's an act. It's either unlawful or it's lawful. We have created this. We have created this term, and we have created an idea of a social category of what it means to be illegal, and we have placed it down on this group, and we have placed barrier after barrier after barrier after barrier in front of them that they cannot cross, that makes it almost impossible to do well here. And not only that, we have taken away any kind of political voice. So if you think about in the midst of this bright picture of assimilation and mobility that we have in this country at large, a small group of people that is over half of all the Mexican immigrants in the U.S. today. It's a big group for them. They cannot work. They cannot pursue education. They cannot speak up. They cannot drive. They cannot do anything. This is creating an underclass, and it's not because they don't want to be a part of us again. It's because we are not letting them assimilate. We are being hypocritical.
It sounded as if Ronald Reagan and George Bush would have made it easy. Ronald Reagan said, you know, collect their taxes and let them come and go as they will. Let them find work as they can. And we can all relax.
Well, I guess he said that and he didn't say that, right? It wasn't until Ronald Reagan that we made it illegal to work as an undocumented immigrant. Before 1986, before IRCA, they could work legally, and he was the one who passed the legislation that made it illegal for them to work. So he contributed to this. He contributed to the early starts of this, and then we build up the border afterwards, right? Everyone.
Why does the Trump wall and the fear in it? They're rapists. They're coming to get us. And besides, we're going to make them pay for it. Mm-hmm. Why does that resonate so? From the first of the Republican debates, he took over the audience with that emotion.
Mm-hmm. Again, I think it gets back to this issue of anxiety. I think there are a lot of causes for our anxiety as Americans today, right? Growing economic inequality, less mobility over time, falling fortunes, declining fortunes. There's a lot of reasons why people are anxious. I can't fully explain why that image comes up of the border, right? What I do know is the border that we've built up so far hasn't worked. And in fact, it's actually been counterproductive and produced greater numbers of undocumented immigrants and a larger undocumented population. I mean, if anything, Trump should be calling to take this down. If he wants to reduce the undocumented population, he should be calling for the opposite. What has come out of the border? The border has made it harder for people to get here, more expensive for people to get here. And so when they come, they have to pay more money to a black market, a newly emerged black market of people who help them get there. They go into greater numbers of debt. They're more likely to die on the border. They have to stay here longer. They have to work longer to pay off these debts. So they stay longer. And instead of going home, now they bring their families and they settle rather than going home like they wanted to. And what's happened, the more you build up a border, the more people stay.
Mm. I'm amazed that nobody has called him on this, just the profoundly un-American sound of a border on our walls. I mean, a wall on our borders. I'm sorry. It just seems so as if there were Mongol hordes coming over into historic China.
People have called him on it. But it's political theater. It's symbolic politics. It's this is a game. Pretend that you can close the front door and let them in the back door, and you'll still get the votes.
We'll see. Thank you, Helen Merrill. Wonderful to meet you and your work. Thanks also to Claudio Lomnitz and Aziz Rana. On our website, radioopensource.org, you can find a lively conversation on Irish arts, letters, and politics with Colm Tobin, the novelist behind the hit film Brooklyn. Our show this week was produced by Max Larkin, Pat Tomeno, Connor Gillies, and Zach Goldhammer. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is El Jefe. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.